Welcome to the Protectors Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Piccolo.
Hey, welcome to the Protectors Podcast. I am excited to be joined by Dan Gabriel. What's going on, brother?
Jason, good to talk with you, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, man. I'm very excited for this podcast. Why? Because I just saw Mosul. It just came out on video. At least I think it did because I just rented it. So I loved it, man. It was a great movie. But before we get to Mosul,
unbeknownst to us, we could have seen it together because you're like a mile and a half from where I live.
Yeah. So Dan and I were chatting before the podcast, and we didn't realize we're only like a few miles away from each other. I'm like, this could have been my first in-person podcast.
Well, all going back to it's a small world, and we talk about the community of people that served in under every stripe since 9/11, and certainly it's just a small world, you know? I mean, how many people do we know in common?
Exactly. So we threw out Pete Turner, Scott Husing, and then it turned into, hey, we know this guy, we know that guy. It's such a small world, man.
It definitely is.
So, Dan, I read your bio, and we've talked. I've followed you on social media. You got all that stuff that's out there, but... And it just kind of briefly overviews, hey, you know what? Dan was in the CIA. But where was Dan before the CIA? That's what I want to know.
Well, it was really a short trajectory from college to the CIA. So I had the misfortune, I guess, or fortune of graduating college 2001. And, of course, we saw what happened in September 2001 with the planes hitting the World Trade Center. And about 16 months after that, I was in the CIA. So for me, I wasn't prior service military. I didn't go through what you guys went through and put in my time and trenches and boot camp and all that stuff. For whatever reason, the agency at that time was looking for a bunch of different profiles, really. And actually, this is something that I learned later on in training. But, they really recruit to the spectrum, a diversity spectrum. And I'm not talking skin color or ideology. I'm talking backgrounds. And my class was the first class recruited after 9/11. We had a NASA scientist. We had an Army Ranger that was in Somalia. We had a stockbroker, a lawyer. I mean, it was that kind of thing. An FBI agent, a DEA guy. So it was really kind of like the A team, if you will. I don't know, again, how I fit in there, but somehow I did and weaseled my way in. And it was an amazing 9 years. Serving the CIA.
Now, what was your, where did you grow up? I mean, I don't want to get too personal because, you have an Intel IC background, but if you don't mind just kind of throwing out some, I grew up here and my degree was blah, blah, blah. Just for, the thing is like, hey, you know what? This guy was in a CIA. Maybe I'll go into CIA. So it's like one of those things.
Well, look, I grew up in Boston, so you're already getting really personal. I was a white Irish Catholic kid from Boston, and after 9/11, to getting back to your point, how did I get in the CIA? 9/11 happened, and I moved to Cairo to study Arabic. I wanted to understand the culture and the language and the people and the politics and all of it. And I did that for about 6 months. I came back to D.C., submitted my application, and I was in the CIA by July of 2003.
Now, what's a white Irish kid in Cairo? What is that like? Especially post 9/11.
I can give you my first impression was stepping off the plane. I think it was maybe a Lufthansa flight out of Paris into Cairo and kind of walking down the terminal in the old Cairo airport. And of course, like the men's room was essentially like a hole in the floor, right? Like you just squat down and you do your thing. So that was a little strange because even in South Boston, like we have more manners than that. But nevertheless, that's how it was. And 6 months later, I appreciated the culture and the religion and the language and the people and grew to love it and grew to appreciate it, which I think is the key to being a successful intel officer. Because at the end of the day, you have to understand And you have to like, frankly, the people that you're dealing with and that you're working with.
You know, that brings me to college. Like, to me, I was an enlisted dude, active duty, and then going to college after that. And it was kind of like a culture shock, you know, because, you know, come, but my, I don't even know where I'm going with that. But the big thing was my,
you did it backwards. You realized if you went to college first, you could have been an officer, you know, I mean, you did it backwards, but good on you anyway.
Well, the big thing was like my favorite class was cultural geography. That's where I was going with it. Cause I'm like, you know, it kind of gives you a perspective. And that's one thing I wish I did when I was just graduated college. I mean, I had a different perspective by going to the border, but going overseas and kind of getting that cultural, the real cultural geography like you did. And I'm sure that sets you up perfectly for your next stint. You know, I mean, obviously.
Well, no, I mean, the term cultural geography is the reason that I'm sure the CIA said, like, we'll take this guy and not the next guy. Because I said, after 9/11, I'm going to Cairo. I want to understand the cultural geography of what the hell is going on. And that level of risk taking for them at that point in time, I don't know how they, what their hiring practices are 15 years later, but that curiosity, that kind of intellectual desire to know more, learn more, that was sufficient at that time. And so I'm like you in that sense. The cultural geography is ultimately what makes a great intel officer or a great journalist.
Well, yeah, and a lot of times people don't realize that they all kind of, and that kind of blends into the investigative world as well, because it's all about human intelligence gathering. It's all about building relationships, and it's always about source development. I mean, we'll get into that later on in the podcast or when we do part two, but yeah, man. I mean, I'm really excited for you. I mean, like, I'm just thinking about your career, like post 9/11, Cairo, this guy really wants to do it. And then you do it. So what is it like to go from, hey, you know what, I'm a civilian, then all of a sudden, bam, I'm into the secretive world of the agency.
So here's the funny thing, and this is what you have to explain to real civilians, and I mean people that didn't serve in the CIA or certainly weren't military, which is the CIA, you are a civilian. We're not military. I mean, we can go home at any time. When I was in Iraq, I could have been like, I want to go home and see mommy at any time. I could have just walked to the helipad and flown home. So we don't have the same level of, you know, I don't even know what the word is, but it's different than joining the military in the sense that you still are in control of your destiny and what you want to do. And sometimes that makes it harder and sometimes it makes it easier to do what you do. And I remember being in Iraq in 2004 and it was like, why the hell am I here? Like, I mean, most guys that joined up, guys and gals that joined up after 9/11, they joined because they wanted to find bin Laden, man. They wanted to go to Afghanistan. Nobody wanted to get sidetracked into Iraq. And frankly, the people that got sidetracked and got sent to Iraq were, I mean, you had to put in your time. You had to do your penance in Iraq. And everybody knew that wasn't the main focus. And if you were worth your salt, you would get to Afghanistan and you would work with the Taliban. You would work with the Northern Alliance and work and live in Kabul and places like Kandahar, because that was the fight. That's why we signed up. And yet Iraq was a diversion. So when you're in Iraq and it's 2004 or 2005 and the war is kind of like, I mean, we're about to go into the surge and things are spinning sideways. And you're like, why am I here? Ultimately for me, and I can tell you for other agency guys too, ultimately it became about, I'm here. Why? Because Jason's here. Like, I'm here because the guy in uniform is here. And if we can make his life any easier or his job any safer, we're going to do it. And frankly, so much of what we did, which frankly, that's not the mission of the agency, was tactical intelligence. There's a bomb here, there's a bomb there. Like, that's not what the agency is designed to do, but we did it. We did it proudly, and we ended up being pretty good at it as almost, I would say, a supplement to what DIA did, because it was so needed and because it was such a lack of a strategic focus or strategic intelligence effort. Everybody missed the insurgency. Everybody was still looking for WMD. But at the same time, we were still good at saying, hey, there, you know, there's an ambush at this checkpoint. There's an IED on this road.
Well, that just builds up your experience for when you want to do go after the HVTs later on, not necessarily just in Iraq, but let's say you're going to go to the Afghanistan, you're going to go to Pakistan, but you're building your knowledge base of actual real world tactical operations in an urban environment and suburban and rural and everything else in Iraq. It kind of sets you up for the Middle East.
Well, I mean, you sound like the HR officer from, you know, like the director of operations in CIA. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what they said. You go do your time in Iraq, you know, you learn how Muslims are and Arabs are and how things go boom. And then you can graduate to the big boy level and then you can go to Afghanistan and focus on the mission of why you got into the agency to begin with, why we're at war in the Middle East, the people that brought down the World Trade Center, et cetera.
Maybe that's my next job, HR for the agency. Okay, guys, here's what the deal is.
Yeah. Actually, you are too young for that. I think that usually they were around 73 is probably the average age for CIA HR people.
I'm sure, man. Hey, so I really want to talk about Mosul because I just saw that. And that's the thing. I kind of wanted to go over your career and your background. Just say, you know what? Now you have a guy who's a subject matter expert. He's got the background, not only in the agency, but you know what, you did it when you went over there as a civilian, like, you know, student, post-student. And how do you go from, what was that transition like? Going from, you know, the agency to all of a sudden I'm going to get into the film industry.
Yeah, so to me, it was actually the transition from what I did as an undergraduate. I was a journalism major guy. I mean, I thought I was going to write for the New York Times or the Washington Post. Of course, I graduated in 2001. All these newspapers are shutting down. I didn't have a face for TV. So I'm like, what am I going to do? You know, I interned at CNN. I had a job offer. I think it was $18,000 a year to work as an operations assistant at CNN. Just didn't seem feasible. But in my heart, I was a storyteller. And this is one of the things I like to say is like, CIA is a place that's full of stories, but yet you can't tell stories. And in many cases, you can't even tell stories after you've left. Yet there's Mosul, and Mosul was near and dear to my heart because I was there. You know, actually, I was there for less than a month, like a very short period of time, 2004 to 2005, right over the new year. But fast forward to 2014, which, by the way, we're at the 5-year anniversary of when Mosul fell to ISIS. So like the timing is kind of hot right now. But it remained kind of a place of like, yeah, this was a formative experience. And after talking to veterans across the country, it's like, what was it all for? If an ideology, a group like ISIS is going to run Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, what were we doing in 04, 06, 08, 09? I mean, why did all these people die? Why did my friends die to let this happen? So Mosul becomes the Saigon of our generation. And you're only a couple of years older than me. And it's like, this is truly the Saigon of Generation X or Y. And our generation put in the sacrifice, and certainly you and your colleagues a lot more than me and my intel buddies. But nevertheless, it becomes a very emotional and personal connection. And that's what I've heard from vets that we'll talk to at all these screenings that we've done across the country.
Now, I got to stop you there because, you know, I have some agency buddies here and there, and they always like, you know, you guys did so much more. But, you know, without that tactical intelligence, I always considered if you were an agency guy or girl in Iraq, then you are serving just like we are. You know, I mean, never discount your service because to me, you're a vet of that war. So, yeah, man.
Well, look, yeah, I know, man. But it all goes back to, you know, you can cry and want to go home to mama. And if you're a CIA guy, you can do that. But no matter how much you cry, you can't leave. So at the end of the day, there may be no other difference. I may have been in more dangerous places than you were. But at the end of the day, I could have been like, I'm good. I'm tired of Fallujah. I want to go home. And that's the end of the story. So nothing else matters.
And listen, we've all squatted in those holes with just deported zombies. So yeah,
so the holes that I saw in the Cairo airport in 2000, really January 2002, and I really didn't understand what those were. Little did I know.
Well, you know, you roll around in Iraq or Kuwait, and all of a sudden you find these porta johns that just have a hole in the floor, and you're like, "What am I doing?" oh, that's okay, audience. That's a little TMI.
You've cut that out, right? when we.
Oh, no, we're keeping it. That. We're keeping that in. That's the real world of the Middle East. But hey, I one thing that really got me about the movie, and I want to go into this. So Mosul, it's out now. You can stream it. You know, I've cut the cable, so I streamed it. I loved it. It was a really good movie. And it, you know, you're not going in there to watch like shoot 'em up, bang it up action documentary. I like the personal. No, and
we've had complaints about that. I got to be honest with your views, because I'm sure a lot of your viewers are shooters and operators. You know, if they're looking for like corn gal, like, yeah, I mean, we have legit combat scenes in there. Like, one, you know, I monitor closely everything that's said on Facebook about the film because this is my baby. You know, some guys have been like, oh, this is staged. Like, no, it's not staged. Like, the guy gets shot in the head, he's bleeding out on the floor. Like, there's nothing about that is staged. But it's not like Coronel, or in the sense that, or let's forget Coronel. It's not like Combat Obscura, which is just like camera on, GoPro, turn it on, and it's just, you know, bullets flying and chaos and carnage. That's not the intent of the film. And it wasn't my background either. The intent of the film is to show story of what happened between October of 2016 and July of 2017. And then parse that down one more level. Some people would be like, well, the Americans were involved in that. No, but if you were in Mosul in 2004 or 2008 or 2010, or if you were involved in Operation Inherent Resolve from Qatar in 2016, this is your fight. This is what you want. This is what you've been waiting for. You have been waiting for the Iraqi forces to stand up on their own two legs and to defeat ISIS. And that's what happens in the film.
Well, there's one Lots aspect of that film that I really want to point out. Was the kids, you know, and I was, you know, the two kids. Now, you guys, if you're listening, you got to watch it. Two kids come up to the minivan, the crew's in, and they're just talking about what's going on. And, you know, you could actually see, I could relate to those kids as being like, you know, some inner city kids here going, yeah, you know what? They pretty much kill anybody. And if, you know, we show our face in the middle of the night and we're not part of the crew, then we're going to get shot, you know?
And one of the kids is kind of like a punk. I mean, he's like, he's telling the journalists, he's like, hey man, you're asking about school. I just told you, I haven't been to school in 3 years. Like, don't you listen? And he's like, yeah, what? I don't know. I don't know about kids, but he's like, what, 6, 8, something?
Yeah. And that's the thing I like about it. And I like how, I mean, really, I like that it wasn't like, hey, you know, we're going to go shoot him up, bang him up. We're going to be shooting ISIS in the face. It's showing you, hey, you know what? ISIS has some evil fucking people in there, and we're going to go out and get them. And we're going to do what we can to change our own country around. So, yeah.
And Jason, that's the hopeful part of the story. And I think there is definitely a hopeful aspect of it in terms of the Iraqi, the different groups within Iraqi society coming together, the Sunni, the Shia, the Kurds, the Christians, the Yazidis. And they do. They come together for the military objective of defeating ISIS in Mosul. But flip the coin, and it's all of a sudden, what's the real message of Mosul? And it's a cautionary tale, because it's these groups have been fighting for hundreds and hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And I would say ISIS is not the cause. ISIS is a symptom of that conflict.
You know, yeah, I mean,
and some of your listeners may be like, ah, yes, no, it's about religion. No, but it's really, ISIS is really more of a symptom of it than anything else. And when you have that power vacuum, when you have these groups fighting each other, the danger, and this is where people need to pay attention. And I my hope is that the administration hasn't like moved on to the next thing, because the danger is that the power vacuum in that part of the world, in Mosul and Raqqa, it's not stable. It's not secure right now. ISIS 3.0 can easily spring from that.
Oh, easily. And that's one part of the movie I wanted to bring up, was that, okay, you listen to the Iraqis going, hey, you know what? Iran never messed with us. They provide us training and money. And then in the beginning of the movie.
That's shocking, man. That's shocking. I mean, people, you know, people that watch Fox News aren't going to be able to understand that the first time. And I've talked to these people, you know, had call-ins on different radio shows. And I'm like, what do you mean Iran was fighting ISIS? Well, look in the film. You see that yellow flag? That's Hezbollah. when you see Om Hanati, the woman, the female, the widow, the vigilante, when she's talking about receiving her pay, she's being paid by the Iranian government. She's a Sunni being paid by the Iranian government to fight ISIS.
So we've got to open our their border. Iran is the border. And why would Iran would rather deal with a known objective or a known quantity rather than an ISIS?
And what Iran did, at least in terms of the battle for Mosul 2016 to 2017, is they finally got to the point where they said, you know, because I think Iran made a calculated bet that they could carve off the northern third of Iraq and just kind of cede it to the Salafists and the Wahhabists and kind of Sunni extremists. And then what they realize is, no, we can't, because by the way, Mosul Dam, by the way, all the oil fields, by the way, all the kind of secondary, you know, orders of effect. So when they get serious about it, that's when you see the, you know, the Iraqi government come together, assemble the security forces. Iran was behind all this. Iran equipped as many of these militias as the U.S. did. You look at some of the weapons, they're all Iranian provided. You look at, again, Om Hanati, the widow, that's kind of one of the, maybe one of the most popular characters in the film. She's paid for by the Iranians. You talk to people in the Iraqi embassy here in D.C., and they're like, ah, she's not really legit. Why do they say that? Because they know that she's essentially an Iranian influence.
Yep.
But yet she was critical to defeating ISIS.
And then so you got to find out, I'd love to see what happens next. I mean, head back in a year and see what the result is, maybe like a follow-up.
Get ready for the sequel. Absolutely.
Exactly. I really enjoyed the movie, though. I mean, I think a lot of it was because it makes it into like, oh, man, you know, you really don't know who these people are. You don't know where their loyalties are. And there's especially a point where they were talking about, you know, people rescuing people on the other side of the river, and you don't know who the ISIS spies and sympathizers are, and you just don't know. I mean, are they coming over here with an S vest on? Or, I mean, it's really good.
Exactly. One of the questions we get so often is, well, where did all these ISIS fighters go? Well, let's go to that river scene that you're talking about, right? Our guys go across in a little tuk-tuk boat, you know, little Boston Whaler with a 10-horsepower engine, and you get all these quote-unquote refugees, male and female, but mostly male, on the other side, waiting to be quote-unquote rescued. And Colonel Nizal, you know, he's saying, lift up your shirt, make sure you don't have a suicide vest on. And these guys come across. Who are they? Who knows? Good guys, bad guys, in-between guys? Nobody knows.
No, absolutely. You have no idea. And you can interrogate them all day long, but if they're not going to break, I mean, you don't have that much time to interrogate them. You got to let them go.
You do. And two things from that point. Number one, look at Om Hanati. Look at the scene where she's interrogating Abu Hamza or Abu something. I can't remember the guy's name. But anyway, she's like, you're the cousin of this bad dude. And he's like, no. Yeah, he's my cousin. But and she's like, no, but you're his cousin. And he's like, yeah. But I'm just his cousin. I don't hang out with him. You know? And she knows exactly who he is. But he's basically saying, I'm just his cousin. It's just a blood coincidence. You know, so that's the first part. Second part is, turn the page to New Yorker article this morning, which is, these people are coming back to the United States. We have people that left the United States, or for that matter, England, France, or Germany, went over there, fought for the caliphate, and now they're dispossessed people. They don't have a country. They don't have a state. They're returning to where they came from. Well, our American jurisprudence doesn't have a way to deal with these people. If you think Guantanamo's, and I know you were there, if you think Guantanamo was complicated in terms of snatching somebody from a battlefield in Afghanistan in the days after 9/11, wait till you get to these people. Because these are women and children that moved to Syria or to Iraq to be part of this. There's no evidence on them, but yet you know that they were fighting with these people, and now they're at Dulles Airport saying, hey, I'm back. What are you going to do?
Absolutely. I've talked about that a bunch of times. Just about
that's a whole different show.
Yeah, I mean, that's just if nobody's ever been encountered by law enforcement, nobody's ever been encountered by the IC. There's no picture, there's no documentation, there's no DNA, there's no fingerprints, and you can never really tell who they are.
That's the scary part.
Whew. Well, on the positive things. So what, now was this, I know this wasn't your first movie. What, how did you end up?
No, this is absolutely, definitely my first movie. Yeah.
Oh, was it really? I thought you had like, you didn't do any shorts or anything else like that.
We did a TV series for a network called El Hura, which is a mixed network. It was on ISIS Texas, but I mean, that was essentially paid for by the network. This is a completely different animal in the sense that we decided, you know, we're going to make this film. It's going to be an independent film. Nobody's going to tell us what to say or what to do. I funded it on my 401k. I was the director. I was the producer. I was all of it. And, you just open it resonates with somebody or some people. And so far it's clear it resonates with veterans.
It really does. I like this. I mean, I'm going to be linking everything I can to it at the end of our podcast. And when I get the podcast up for everybody, but yeah, man, I really dig this movie. Now, what is next for you?
That's a great question. I probably have another, I don't know, 2 or 3 months promoting this film. And that's actually a big deal in and of itself. It's a lot of work, you know, talk to a lot of folks like yourself, just trying to get the word out. But we're already looking at the next film. I mean, we talked about in tongue-in-cheek a sequel, but there is a sequel to this thing. And what I want to do is I want to look at the region from 30,000 feet because we've kind of been at 1,000 feet. But I want to do a look at the conflict between Sunni and Shia, between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Because in my opinion, so much of that drives even what we saw in Mosul, what we see in Syria. And I think that will maybe provide even more explanation for kind of what we're going through.
Well, that's also a learning thing. Cause you know, you try to ask anybody the difference between the sex and they're like, but if you show it like common sense, like Mosul is just common sense. And if you show that from the 30,000, you have to be perfect.
That's exactly right.
I love to see what happens. I love that, you know, the story about, hey, you know what, the war's over and you're shipping these people back to wherever they're going to and follow them out. I'd love to see that, man.
Well, I think in many cases, I mean, the like I said, the next, I don't want to call it the sequel, but it's a follow on in the sense that what we want to explore is the proxy wars that are going on. And Iraq is part of it. I mean, Iraq is a proxy war just as much as Yemen is or Lebanon or Syria. And what you really see is Sunnis fighting the Shia, Saudis fighting the Iranians in all of these different countries, even in some cases using superpowers like Russia and the United States to accomplish what it is ultimately that they want. This goes back 600 years, 700 years to the split and that religion, and it's still playing out today.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to tracking you and following your career. And I'm also looking forward to so Dan and I are going to do a part two in person. We've discussed that before this, and we'll go more in depth about, you know, just everything in general, not just Mosul, but everything else.
100%, man.
Now, is there anything besides the movie, where can we find you?
So the easiest place is mosul-film.com. So there's a lot of information about the film there. There's information about myself, the different filmmakers. I'm on Twitter at Dan P. Gabriel. We stay in touch and look forward to engaging with any and all of your audience.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming on, brother. I really appreciate this.
My pleasure. And we'll pick up a Nats game real soon.
Sounds good, man.